And that's why I talk about a bucket list, because it's a great mechanism to define those things that will bring you those, that sense of purpose, those things that are truly important to you, that you love, that will bring you that fulfillment. And the list is just a device so you don't forget about those things.
Hi everyone, Drew Prode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. I'm recording this on my iPhone because I'm in quarantine. I hope you are too. We're taking a break from immune system conversations and COVID-19, but we're still staying on the topic of self-reflection with today's guest, Ben Nempton, who's gonna talk to us about what we want to do before we die. What's important to us? You know, in this time of self-quarantine, it's a great time to slow down and ask ourselves the most important questions in our life. We will get through this and then life will come back to normal, but how do you want your life to be when things come back to some version of normal? When we can travel again, when we can build, when people who have lost their jobs finally get those jobs back and the economy recovers. What do we want our life to look like? This interview will help you start asking those important questions and start to step into designing your life intentionally. It was recorded pre-quarantine. That's why Ben and I are sitting in the same room. I think you're gonna love it. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast, where we dive deep into the topics of neuroplasticity, epigenetics, mindfulness, functional medicine, and mindset, all with the goal of helping you understand that your brain is not broken. I'm your host, Drew Prode, and each week, my team and I invite a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and most importantly, live more. This week's guest is someone who's gonna do exactly that. He's gonna talk to us about living more. We have Ben Nempton on the podcast with us. Ben is the number one New York Times bestselling author of What Do You Want to Do Before You Die? An important question. And the star of MTV's highest rated show ever on iTunes and Amazon called The Buried Life. As the co-founder of the Buried Life movement, Ben's message of radical possibility has been featured on The Today Show, The Oprah Winfrey Show, CNN, Fox, and all those other channels and stations. President Obama himself called Ben and the Buried Life Project an inspiration for a new generation, and Oprah declared their mission truly inspiring. Ben, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
It's good to have you on here. We've been friends for a while, acquaintances actually more. We haven't really had a chance to hang out, but we have mutual friends, and I've been wanting you on here to talk about your work. Tell the people, who are you and what do you stand for?
Well, I grew up in Victoria, BC in Canada, and I've been living in Venice Beach for about 10 years. And right now what I stand for is most people die with regrets. They regret the things that they didn't do. And I'm trying to bring that percentage down and get more people in the minority that die feeling, you know what, I at least went after the things I truly wanted to before I die, or at least I did the things that I really wanted to do before I die. So that's sort of been my mission as of late, is to try and increase that minority that dies content.
You know, I've seen one of your talks before and listened to a bunch of podcasts and didn't get a chance to read the whole book, but started skimming through the book that was there. And I've seen you open up your talks and you start off with, you know, when it comes to the end of our life, mm-hmm. people regret something specific. What do they regret? Fill in the blank.
So most people regret, and this comes from a study written by a guy named Tom Gilovich, who's a psychologist, well-known psychologist in the U.S. He's also a professor at Cornell. And he actually did six studies, but he wrote one academic paper in the journal Emotions. And effectively what he found is that 76% of people, their number one regret in their entire life is not living their ideal self. So living the life that someone else wanted for them, not themselves. Which for me, when I heard that, I thought that's heartbreaking. I mean, the majority of the population is gonna live their entire life, get to the end of their life when it's too late and look back and think, fuck, I blew it. Like, I didn't take time for the small things that were really important to me, or I was living the life someone else wanted. And I think that is human nature to do that. I think there are many reasons why, and actually Mr. Gilovich found sort of three main reasons why humans tend to do that and end up with those regrets that we can get into later. But I think that for the most part, this idea that we postpone our personal goals, right? We push the things that we believe are important to us again and again and again, sometimes subconsciously, sometimes consciously. And we realize when it's too late that we actually really want to do those things and now we don't have time. So my goal is to remind people that really, like, you have permission to go after those things for many different reasons, right? Like, it's important for your own well-being, but it's also important for the people around you, because you can't take care of other people if you don't take care of yourself. And it has implications for your career in, like, sort of work-life harmony, as well as, you know, your legacy, because at the end of the day, you don't want to die feeling like that. So that's really a driver for me. And I think that that kind of says it all when you think about the work that I'm doing. It's really based around that core problem that most people are dying with regrets.
Let's talk hero's journey. Mm. You grew up in Canada, mm. and you had some, what we would call, like, a quarter life crisis.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that would put it lightly, for sure. And this was, I mean, I was just coming out of high school, and it was, life was really good. Like, I had a scholarship to a university in my hometown in Victoria, BC. I just made the U19 national rugby team, and in Canada, rugby is a huge sport, and the West Coast is like the epicenter of rugby. So it's like football in the South. That's what rugby on the West Coast is, right? So it's just, it's a big thing. And so I made the U19 national team. I played the fly half position, which was the quarterback slash field goal kicker. So ton of pressure. And we were training for the World Cup, and we were getting closer and closer to our trip overseas. And I was practicing field goals, you know, but in the back of my mind, I was remembering, or I had this fear, and I was like, what if I miss an easy kick at the World Cup right in front of the goalpost? And I had missed a big kick at a big game in high school, and it haunted me. And so this was fueling this fear. And these thoughts would come at night, and they came in the form of anxiety, and this anxiety caused me to have trouble sleeping, and this constant pressure I put on myself, this anxiety, this lack of sleep ultimately sort of led me to slide into a depression. And I'd never experienced anything like this before in my life. Up until this point, very happy-go-lucky guy, awesome group of friends, high achiever, you know, for the most part, really good family, good support system. And all of a sudden, this anxiety and my depression stopped me from going to my first year at university where I had my scholarship, right? So I'd literally drive up to school, and I couldn't get out of the car, so I'd drive back home. And so I dropped out of school. And then I became so crippled that I couldn't go to rugby practice. So I, you know, I told my coach I had a herniated disc, and I got dropped for the national rugby team. And ultimately became—
You told your coach that, but did you make that up?
Yeah, I made it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and ultimately I became a shut-in in my parents' house, unable to leave the house. And I was crippled by this indecision that ultimately would be my decision to do nothing, right? Like I couldn't decide whether I could go to school, or I could go to practice, or I could go hang out with friends, and I would be in this place of indecision where ultimately I just wouldn't do anything, and I stayed at home. And so it was this time in my life where it was got darker and darker. You know, I'd worked so hard for these things, and I put so much value sort of against these, my academics, my sport, you know, all this stuff, and all of a sudden it was gone. And so my parents were trying to help. They didn't know what to do. And they would just encourage me to go for a walk every day. So I'd go for my walk, but a lot of times I would just hide in the driveway. And then I'd come back and I'd tell my parents I went for a walk. And it was just a really terrifying time. And so this lasted for, you know, months, you know, talked with psychiatrists, psychologists, just therapists, and nothing really helped. And ultimately what made the difference was friends of mine came at the end of the semester that I dropped out of, and they convinced me to come work with them in a new town for the summer. And they kind of rallied me, and ultimately I went with them, and I was forced to get a job. So I started to feel some confidence and some self-worth. I was started talking about what I was going through ultimately, and I started realizing that I wasn't the only one that was going through some of these feelings. And I started meeting young people that were really inspiring. You know, these kids that had started their own businesses out of college, or, you know, they had just traveled already. And I was kind of like, wow, like these are, you know, I get a lot of energy from these types of people. And I kind of thought, you know what? I was driving home. I was starting to feel back to myself. I thought, I'm going to actually like try and only surround myself with people that inspire me. Just like those people. And there were, you know, some friends where I grew up that were like that. One kid had started a clothing line out of nowhere, and I was so fired up about it, and I wanted to get involved, and so I started, you know, gravitating towards him. And then I was like, you know, I want to make a movie. And so I called this kid Johnny, who was from the neighborhood, who was a self-taught filmmaker, and I said, Johnny,
took like your sister to prom.
Yes, yeah, that's right. There was really not many things I knew about him. I knew he made movies, and I knew he took my sister to prom, so I was very conflicted. And so I just out of the blue gave him a shout and said, Johnny, let's make a movie. And he said, oh yeah, let's, like, I was talking to my other friend Dave about this. And so we gathered Dave, who is a friend from the neighborhood, Duncan, who's Johnny's older brother. So four of us, never really met before or hung out, definitely, you know, we just kind of knew each other by through the neighborhood. Four of us get together, we're like, all right, let's make a movie. What's it going to be about? No idea. And we come up against creative roadblocks, and we're like, time passes, we go back to school. Johnny's at McGill University in Montreal, and he's a first year, and he's the professor, he's sitting in English class, and his English professor assigns him a poem that's 150 years old, and the poem's called The Buried Life. And something in that poem strikes him, and he sends us the poem, and he's like, guys, read this poem. And this poem is articulating this feeling that we can't articulate, but we all have in common, which is that we have all these things that we want to do, but we haven't done them because they're buried. And every once in a while, we get fired up and we're inspired. You know, when we see a friend do something really cool, or, you know, we get inspired about an idea, but the day to day buries that. So we think, wow, this dude wrote this poem 150 years ago, and he's feeling the same way we are feeling right now. We're probably not the first people to feel like this. Why don't we take this name, The Buried Life, even before we knew what the movie was going to be about? So then we think, well, how do we unbury our dreams? And that's when we ask this question, what do you want to do before you die? Because this thought of death was the only thing that shook us enough into the present moment to actually have us internalize what was truly important.
In fact, you've shared that there was also a friend of yours in the community that had passed away at that time.
Yeah, and that was one of Duncan's really good friends who, he was on a camping trip with, you know, it's like a group of friends went on a camping trip, and the next morning they found one of their friends had drowned. And so that was Duncan's really good friend. He was on that trip. And so, you know, by association, we were all sort of faced with death for kind of the first time. And it had a sobering effect. And it's funny how when you think about death, it makes you think about life. And when you digest that mortality, it starts to, it gives you a clearer picture of what's truly important. So,
and what's your mental state at this point in time, right?
So now I'm starting to have this creative outlet, which as I look back and now I know is very important for my mental health and well-being, is to be able to express my creativity. And I hadn't had anything to express my creativity at this point. So this is now I'm starting to like have a lot of fun. I'm starting to express my true self through creativity, and we're making, you know, we're starting to fundraise, and we have this idea, and we have this shared mission, and it's starting to gain traction, right? So we write this list, which really stems from the question, what do you want to do before you die, right? So we ask ourselves, what do you want to do before you die? There's a lot of answers, and we make this list. And it's like the most epic bucket list we could ever think of. We're like, if you have $100 million in your bank, if you can do anything, what would you do? Go to space, make a TV show, sit with Oprah, have a beer with, you know, Prince Harry, like pay off our parents' mortgage. And then we think, okay, let's go after this list. Let's just see how many we can do on a road trip. But let's also ask people along the way, what do you want to do before you die? And then if we can help them do their bucket list, we will. Because there's no way we're going to be able to accomplish our list on our own. We're going to need the help of other people. So let's just see if we can cross something off our list and then help someone else, you know, every time we check something off. It'll sort of be a one for one. So this is 2006, right? So now we have the idea, and we throw parties as fundraisers. We cold call companies looking for sponsors. We get a juice company to pay for our gas. We get a local skate company to give us skateboards and t-shirts to give away. We bore an RV, we like literally pull this RV out of a swamp and take it to a mechanic. And he's like, I don't expect this to make it back, you know? And we make matching t-shirts, and we're like, all right, let's go. 2 weeks on the road, go after a list, help other people, Let's see what happens. And that's sort of the first adventure without knowing what would happen after that. But we just envisioned 2 weeks, make a movie for our friends. This will be fun.
So a few things on that I have some questions for you on. One of our mutual friends, Alex, author of The Third Door, who's been on this podcast before, you know, he came on the podcast and he talked about being in school, feeling like I don't want to be pre-med anymore. I don't want to be a doctor. I need to go do something different. Your family, in mm-hmm. the case of they were telling you to go take a walk, they were concerned about you.
Yeah.
They cared about you. When they started seeing this new direction, what was the response like?
I was very lucky that they didn't support me financially, but they supported me emotionally.
Actually, the combination of those two things is probably a good idea.
In hindsight, yes, absolutely. And what I mean by that is, and I think it was my mom who said it. She said, you know, look, and this happened also later when there was real opportunity with Buried Life and I had to choose between continuing with school or dropping out. But she said, look, I took 7 years off school and then I went back. She said, school will always be there. If this is an opportunity and this is something that you love, go for it. And so both my parents are self-employed and, you know, they're around a lot. And I saw them live this life that was, you know, they kind of designed, you know, they didn't make a ton of money, but they made that money last. And they both played music and they traveled and I would travel with them since I've been like 2 years old. And so they sort of saw how excited I got about it. And, you know, I don't think they really understood it. I don't think really anybody did, but they supported, you know, me to continue to go after it. And so that was ultimately important because it's very difficult. You know, from people that I've had conversations with to do those types of things, when you have the pressure of your parents pushing you in one direction. And, you know, I talk about this like, and people around you as well, like basically like dream killers or whatever, you know, like this idea that some people are going to give you energy, some people are going to take energy, and like you want to gravitate towards those people that inspire you and give you that energy and try and distance yourself from the people that are taking energy or bringing you down. Well, when it's your family, it's hard to distance yourself from that energy sometimes. And so I think it's just trying to create that awareness where you can kind of, you know, put up a little bit of a blocker and continue to do the things that you know you love to do, but also just keep that awareness alive.
So along with family, there's also the social pressure of friends. And being yeah. in rugby, I'm sure you had a close group of guy friends that you were part of your community and a team and a tribe
yeah.
that was all working towards a common goal. When you had shared that you had this physical issue, yeah. the herniated disc, did any of them know that you had kind of made it up? Were they trying to tell you, like, you throwing your life away? Like, what are you doing? This is, like, the best thing that's going on. What was the peer pressure like at that time?
Yeah, I mean, it was high because in hindsight, I realized that the real reason I was playing rugby was to be accepted, you know, was to be in in the crew of guys that were looked up to. And so I think that contributed to part of my depression was that like I was doing something for the wrong reason. And so when it now in hindsight I can see that like I liked playing rugby, but it wasn't meant for me. And so when I ultimately stopped playing, yeah, like I wasn't involved in those circles really, like, you know, the parties and that type of thing. But I think it forced me in the right direction because I was forced to surround myself with other types of people that were going to inspire me in different ways. And so it's not easy though.
You know, so depression is a spectrum and we've done deep episodes on depression yeah. and we talk about gut health and yeah. mental health and all that sort of stuff. But it seems to be that on that spectrum, because it's very real and you were the one that was experiencing it, I went through something similar myself too in university. It seems like there was this gap between what you felt inside was possible, like you felt like I'm meant to do something more, but then not knowing the direction that you could take, not knowing a path or having examples of people that were out there. Because, I mean, I don't know all the details and you don't have to share anything that you mm-hmm. don't want to, but it seems the primary shift was the continuation of like being with this new group and having a purpose, having a sense of what you were going to be part of. And not everybody's depression is that, but for some people it is.
Absolutely. And I think that as you grow and you get older, you start to learn the things that contribute to your own wellness, and you almost like bank those in your toolkit as you go. And as I said, creativity, I think, is something that's often overlooked. I think it's a pillar of wellness just to be able to express that in any way that resonates with you, because I think it's sort of, you know, you start to get depressed when you're not being able to express yourself in a true, authentic way in some ways. And so another piece of that, or like, so if we call this like the mental health toolkit, another thing in the toolkit for me, and as you just mentioned, I think it's with a lot of people, is purpose. And that purpose can show up in many different ways. It can be your vocation, right? What you do every day and is sort of purpose driven, or at least you feel that deep inside you. Or it's other things that you do, right? And that's why I talk about a bucket list, because it's a great mechanism to define those things that will bring you that sense of purpose, those things that are truly important to you, that you love, that will bring you that fulfillment. And the list is just a device so you don't forget about those things.
And so one question on that. Yeah. So we'll come back to your story in a second, but I saw a clip of you say, forget everything you think you know about a bucket list.
Yeah.
Take us from there.
When we think about bucket list, I think we gravitate towards the adventure, the travel, the exciting, you know, the bungee jump, the skydiving, go to Italy, all these things, which are incredible things to do. But expand your idea of what a bucket list is. Think about all the categories of your life, you know, spiritual, emotional, material, financial, professional, all these buckets, you sort of make up your life. And I encourage you to think about all aspects of your life when you're thinking about your bucket list, because your bucket list is a reflection of you, a full reflection. It's almost like you turn yourself inside out, and these are the things that are truly important to you in your life. So, and it's different for everybody. So there really is no definition to a bucket list. I would say the only thing you can use to peg it is that it's going to bring you happiness, joy, and fulfillment. And so those things, that can be calling your mom once a week, spending more time with family, finally writing that book, buying the house on the beach, getting that job, you know, or being a more effective leader, or making an impact in the community, or starting that nonprofit. You know, it's really just something that gives you a feeling, right? Either a feeling of excitement, or there's a curiosity there, or it like warms your heart. And so I think those are the roads to follow when you're thinking about your list. And then it exists to remind you that those things are important to you. Because if you don't have something to remind you, they get buried, right? Mm-hmm. That's the thing that's been happening for hundreds of years. That's why the poem was written in 1852.
Thousands of years, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. Because the day-to-day buries these things. And it's because we have deadlines for every other sort of aspect of our life, which pushes these things to the back burner. And it's because we wait to feel inspired to go after our personal goals, but that inspiration rarely hits. And it's also because we're afraid, right? Fear is the number one thing that holds us back from going after our personal goals, whether it's the fear of failure or the fear of what other people think. Both very deep-rooted human fears. But when you break down those fears and you look at, okay, let's take a step back and look at the fear of what other people think. This actually is said to be rooted in hunter-gatherer times, when if we went out for a hunt and came back without a kill, we're at risk of getting kicked out of the tribe. If you did something wrong in the tribe, you got kicked out, that meant certain death. So this fear of what other people think made sense. It's like, well, I'm gonna die if I do something wrong and they think I'm messed up.
Because they'll be isolated, and it's very hard for one human being to live kind of on their own, fetch water, hunt, everything.
You can't survive outside of the tribe. So cut to, you know, generations later, this fear has been passed on, but now it's less life or death. So let's assume you have your basic needs met, right? Like safety, shelter, food, things that are sort of the basic human needs. And this fear of what other people think. Here's the thing. I mean, I hate to break it to you, but people are typically thinking about you much less than you think they are. Like, that's the fun thing, right? Because they're too worried about what other people think about them. So just straight up, people are not thinking about you as much as you think. Second, they're more accommodating than you think. At least that's what I found, you know? Like if you do something and you do something, you think they're going to think that you're like, oh, I can't believe that guy did that. What an idiot. Like usually they don't think that. They're like, they respect you doing things and putting yourself in a vulnerable position. So this fear of what other people think is closer to the made up fear, right? It's like that saying in my 20s, sorry, what is it? Like in your 20s, you're worried about what other people think. In your 40s, you don't care about what other people think. In your 60s, you realize they were never thinking about you in the first place, right? So it sort of gives you some perspective and you are able to identify, okay, this is like more of a made up fear. Like what are the real risks here? What's the real fear? And so then the fear of failure, you know, very common fear. But if you're afraid to go after your goal or you're waiting for the right time, you failed. So at least when you try and you fail, you learn something. And that usually far outweighs any potential hit to your reputation.
So let's jump back to your story. You guys set off on this journey to start on this project. You were filming it.
Yeah.
What are some of the experiences you had and how does that roll up in to a miniature movement that turns into a bigger movement?
So we hit this road in this ratchet RV, right? We're just, the mechanic said, you're not gonna be able to drive this back home. And we didn't have enough money to tow it back home. So this was like a real kind of like, should we do this or not? Like, is this just totally ridiculous? And ultimately we said, okay, we come this far, let's hit the road. And as we hit the road, something interesting happens. Some of these list items that we thought were impossible, over time, they start to fall off the list. And then we start to help other people in ways that we never imagined
fall
we
off
could.
Fall off the list means you cross them
off. We cross
off the
them
list.
Off, yeah. So, you know, this took time, but like, let's just say, let's go to the first tour. So this is 2006, we hit the road in our old RV. We get in the news and all of a sudden it's sort of national news, four guys going after their dream list and all this incoming support comes through our website. So people start sending us emails saying, hey, I saw your list online. You know, number 9, ride a bull. My buddy has a bull ranch, he can get you on a bull. Oh, I saw, you know, number 42, make a toast at a stranger's wedding. Like my friend's getting married, I'm the best man, I can get you in. And then people sending us their dreams and sort of we're getting inundated with people's dreams asking for our help to help them cross things off their list. And so after this 2-week road trip, we've crossed off all these list items, we've helped people in a way that we didn't think we could, and that's really resonated in a deep way. We're like, wow, we didn't expect that. And we come back after this 2-week road trip and we're like, wow, like we gotta keep doing this. You know, that was, we have this sense of purpose and we've had it so much fun and it's created this sort of bubbling excitement around the country. And so we think, you know what, let's do it again next summer. Let's go back to school, let's save up more money. And we threw parties throughout the rest of the year. We did whatever we could to save up money. And next summer we buy a 1968 purple transit bus that we got on Craigslist. From a nudist, actually. And so next summer we're like, after bigger list items, we cross off like sing the national anthem to a packed stadium at an NBA game. We're able to help take kids that are terminally ill with cancer on a shopping spree at Toys R Us. We continue to surprise ourselves with what's possible.
And all along the way, you're helping somebody else with their list too?
Yep.
What were some of the examples, if I could just interject here, you named some really cool things that you guys were doing. What were some of the goals that other people had that you were helping them with in those early days?
So the very first person that we helped was someone sent us an email. He said, hey, my name's Brent. I'm 24 years old. Before I die, I want to bring pizzas down to the homeless shelter. And so we thought, cool, let's go interview Brent and sort of figure out why this is something that's on his list. And we find out when we interview him that the reason why he wanted to bring pizzas down to the homeless shelter is because he had lived in that homeless shelter for many years.
Wow.
And he said, when people came in with food, it felt like the best day because it felt like someone actually cared about him. And then we learned that Brent had pulled himself out of that homeless shelter by starting his own landscaping business. And his landscaping business relied on his old pickup truck. And his old pickup truck had recently broken down. And so when we asked him, hey, you know, is there anything we can do to help? He wouldn't mention the pickup truck. He'd bring it back to giving the pizzas. And so we got together, the four of us, like, we gotta figure out a way to get this guy a truck. But we had $480 between the four of us. And so we went to an RV, went to a used car salesman, and we told them the story of Brent, and the cheapest truck was $2,100. And we said, we have $480. And not only did he give us the truck for $480, but he paid for the insurance out of his own pocket.
Wow.
So we drove the truck up to Brent, tossed him the keys, and the look on his face, I mean, he just was, he immediately bear hugged me and started to cry. And he just hung on. And then, yeah, no one had ever done anything like this for him in his life. And we had never done anything like this for someone else. And so that combination just made it a really memorable moment. And we kind of came back from that. And we sort of thought, like, that's why we got to keep doing this.
Mm.
Yeah.
And for you in that moment, was that the second summer that you guys went out?
That was the first one. Yeah.
So you in that moment, you know, just a few months ago or a year ago, you know, you're in debilitating depression that's preventing you from even taking a walk around the block.
Mm.
What did it feel like to you on a personal level when you were sitting there with him and receiving this hug, and like kind of afterwards, after the shock of it all, because right, I'm sure you're just in the emotional state in the present moment of just having just compassion in your heart. Afterwards, can you remember thinking like, wow, how much things have changed from where I came from?
Yeah. And in hindsight, it's pretty clear that there's this connection between giving and then your own well-being. And, you know, when you think about this mental health toolkit that we referenced earlier, you know, when you help someone else, your brain doesn't have the capacity to think about that other person and how crappy you feel. So you take yourself out of your own head thinking about yourself, and you think about someone else, and you build a meaningful connection, which creates a sense of well-being. So this connection, it exists to this day. You know, we're still in contact with Brent. We 2 years after that, we went back and we surprised him with his first year at community college. So we were able to get half of it sponsored through the school and able to get the funds for the other half. So, you know, so got him going with college. And that meaningful human connection just fills you up, right? Like it kind of lights up your head and your heart at the same time. And it's resonates, it sticks with you, you know. Like I feel as though, you know, if you look at the things that we did on our list and the things that we helped other people accomplish on their list, I'm sure that the things that we did on our list will stick with me until I die. But I'm positive that those big gives, when we were able to share a moment with someone that meant so much to them, is just this immediate, you know, you can't help but feel connected, that because it's like this is a moment that just really touches them, and you're there to actually share in that, and that like bonds to you, and that will, I'm positive, will stick with me until I die. And so just without knowing it, we learned this really valuable lesson about the importance of just giving, you know, not only for the other person, but for yourself.
And, you know, I think about, you know, you said you have very open-minded parents who are very supportive mm-hmm. for your journey. I'm sure even then still you guys had your own thing, just like every family does. I think about my parents, who are also pretty open-minded for Indian parents, immigrants to this country, born in Kenya, but our ancestry is from India. And I think about my dad's bucket list. And my dad's bucket list, you know, I was born on August 1st, 1982 in Nairobi, Kenya. Mm-hmm. And the day where I was born, my dad couldn't come to the hospital because there was a coup attempt where the army tried to take over the president. And so there was a nationwide curfew, and everything was shut down. Bombs were going off. They made my mom move into the basement and give birth down there, like with just like one nurse. And my dad didn't know, is my mom okay? Am I okay? Does he have a kid? Does he not have a kid? Like, what's going on? Wow. And at the time, he set the intention, like, I just want to be somewhere safer for my family, better for my family. And that was like his bucket list. Yeah. Like, I want to give my kids the gift of, you know, we were still middle class over there. It's not like we were very poor or anything, but it's like, I want to give my family a stable life and a stable education. And I often think about like that generation of whether they're immigrants or parents that were here, sometimes they're just looking to make a better life for their kids. And that was kind of like their bucket list.
Totally.
And then our generation, how old are you?
36.
Yeah, so we're right around the same age. So in our generation, it's like we grew up with those comforts. We grew up with those things.
Yeah.
We grew up with having all the fruits of labor that our parents put into everything. And then there's something about shifting our situation and giving ourselves the perspective of like, holy shit, this guy was born into a situation, or whether he ended up in a situation where he was homeless and didn't even have food. And the thing that would make his week was somebody bringing pizza from the outside. I think those perspectives are so important, because when you don't know anything different than your own life that you're living right now, you don't even know how good you have it.
No, you don't. Yeah. You have your blinders on to some extent. And I met a woman a week ago who's, you know, we were talking about lists, and she said, you know, my list for the last 10 years has just been to create stability and independence so I could leave my husband with my son and build a new life. And she's like, I started as a teller at the bank, and now I'm the bank manager. And that has been the only thing that I've wanted to do for the past 10 years. And that is the exact example of a list, right? Like, that's why I think you, when you expand your mind to what this thing is, it's finding a better life for your family. You know, it's moving out of this current situation that is causing you pain. It is getting over a fear that is holding you back, or it's bungee jumping out of a helicopter, you know, or it's, you know, eating your way across Italy. You know, like, it's no judgment. These are all things that are going to bring you joy and happiness, because the idea is, if you are more fulfilled and you are happier, the more people that are more fulfilled and more happier, I should say, the better the world will be. And that is, it's a bit of a airy-fairy type of statement, but I truly believe that if more people were living their true self and doing the things that, giving themselves permission to be that person they needed to be, it would have this ripple effect around the world that would make a real tangible impact. And I think this idea of a ripple effect is such a powerful thing, because it's something that we clued into after we started this. And I used to think a bucket list was selfish, right? I was like, you know, these are personal goals. Like, I look at all the people I should be taking care of, or all my responsibilities I have, you know, even someone that didn't have that many responsibilities. But what happened was all these people all around the world were suddenly being inspired to go after their list by us going after our list. So when you do what you love, you inspire other people to do what they love. And that creates a ripple effect. And so then all these other people that were inspired did something that inspired other people. And so there's all these people that have been inspired by Buried Life that have gone on to do incredible things, things much bigger than what we did, right? And they impacted more. So that, you look at this sort of funnel that goes out and you're like, wow, that is an exponential impact. And you draw that back to Buried Life, but it doesn't draw back to Buried Life. Because if you draw back further to what inspired us to do Buried Life, it really comes back to that one kid that I mentioned that started the clothing line in high school. And this, out of the blue, he started this clothing line. He took out a loan, no experience in fashion, just created this really dope clothing line. And I was like, whoa. I just said, how did you do that? And he said, what do you mean? I just did it. I said, I want to, can I get involved? Like, I was able to like help him get on a blog or something. And I was like, wow, that was awesome.
Him going after his thing.
Inspired. And he did that. I said, you know what? If he did that, what can I do? I said, I want to make a movie. I called up Johnny. Keep in mind, this clothing line was not successful. It lasted for a couple years. You know, you could say it was a failure. If he wouldn't have started that clothing line, none of this impact would have happened. He changed the world by starting that clothing line that only lasted for 2 years. That's the power of the ripple effect, and that proves that one person can create an incredible impact.
And I love what you said, which was no judgment on the goals. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's things both selfish and selfless, and we can hold both of those bucket list items at the same time.
Yeah.
Because they mean something to us. Now, I think for a lot of people, just like you guys are experiencing, you know, you can achieve these incredible things on your bucket list, like giving the toast at a stranger's wedding.
Yeah.
Or being and hosting the local news. I think you wanted to open up the 6 a.m. news that was there. And it's like, wow, that was cool. And that's a cool story. And then you can do a contrast where you give somebody who's been homeless, who pulled himself up and managed on their own accord to start a landscaping company, and feel like, whoa, this is a different feeling. One's not, you know, they're all meaningful. And I think you need them both at times.
Absolutely. And I think that it just depends on who you are and what you need. But I think this idea that it's selfish to have personal goals is really backwards, because you can't take care of other people if you don't take care of yourself. So if you want to show up in the world and create the largest impact, you need to optimize your well-being. How do you do that? Well, one way you do that is you do the things that you love, because that fuels you up. That gives you more energy. You can deploy that energy in any way that you wish. So you're putting yourself in a position to serve others, right? So it's not selfish, it's actually service. And this applies to leadership, you know, in the workplace. This applies to your day-to-day. But it's just the idea of, you know, when you take off in an airplane, the flight attendant says, in case of emergency, put on your own oxygen mask before serving others. Because you can't serve others if you can't breathe. So by fueling yourself, you're able to be the best version of yourself, and therefore you're able to help others. So like, I speak to a lot of folks in healthcare, even like teaching professions, who tend to put other people first, right? They're just those types of people. They got into into a service job, and they are burnt out, right? And they are stressed, and they are battling different mental illnesses and struggles. And a part of the reason is that there's this idea in our heads that we gotta, you know, it's selfish for me to take care of myself. I need to give. So trying to rewire that in the brain, and it's like, no, this is the only way you can take care of other people, you know, is by nourishing yourself, doing these things that are truly important to you, creates that work-life harmony. And what's interesting is now you look at companies that are like thriving and really investing in the full associate, or these sort of real true people first cultures. Well, it's because they're investing in the full employee, not just the professional, the personal. So, you know, companies like Lululemon, companies like Intel, you know, Lincoln Financial and stuff like that, what they do is they actually invest in their employees' dreams. And that creates this environment where people are like, wow, I get to be my true self. You know, I don't want to leave, you know? And so then you get this peer-to-peer facilitation of dreams. And so it's a really powerful idea. And I think it's something that we sometimes are wired to think just the opposite.
I think, you know, we have a lot of parents that listen to this podcast, and especially for a lot of moms where the burden falls a lot on them. It's like everybody else is first.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm a martyr. And I think the important message that's there is that if you really don't look after your goals and dreams and the daily fundamental, it could be the daily bucket list items that bring a little bit of joy and happiness within the constraints, just being able to go out and get that cup of coffee,
yep,
just being able to set up some sort of support or asking for a little bit of help to try to take that it sounds crazy, but like that shower in between while the baby's sleeping and, you know, whatever it might be, those things fuel us and they're important for everything else we'll do. So I want to come back to the story because I've interrupted a couple of times. Okay. Yeah. I zoom in and zoom out. That's just my style. When did you start to notice that, whoa, this is really starting to turn into something much bigger? So we're in the second summer of the Buried Life Project. Yes. You're going around doing bucket list items, also helping other people. What do you notice from there?
So there's this energy that's building and we're starting to get notes on the front of the bus, right? We have this big transit bus and we're getting notes on the front of it that say, here's my dream, can you help me? People are starting to recognize us on the streets.
And is this and because how?
This is now, this is just media. Traditional media. Yeah, traditional this is 2007. Media. You know, we just had a Twitter account at that point, but it wasn't going viral, but we had made a YouTube video in 2006 that made the front page of YouTube. And it was like a, you know, it was maybe 500,000 views or something. And so what was interesting was through that process, we actually got offered a show in Canada after the first tour by MTV Canada, which we ultimately turned down because they were going to own it and we didn't want to give away ownership and we wanted to keep making our documentary. So we respectfully declined the show in Canada. We did the second tour for 2 months, continued to build, the press continued to come in. We started to get more and more emails come in and we're fired up about making our documentary. And we come home after that 2 months on the road. We had hired a full crew from LA to follow us. We had gotten big sponsors and raised a lot of money, put it all into the film, right? We're talking 2 months with a four-person crew from LA in a separate RV following us, right? So it's like we invested, you know, mid six figures into this. Didn't take a dime. We get back to home. We're all fired up. We got the best documentary. And then we realize how expensive post-production is. And also 2007, what are we going to do with this film? How are we going to like sell it? There's no Netflix. There's no OTTs. Maybe we get it into it's a festival darling and it gets distribution. So now all of a sudden, big crash. We don't know what to do. We don't have any money left. I go in to work in a bar in Vancouver. I start to get depressed again. I'm working in a bar. I don't even know how to bartend. I just pretend that I have experience from working in Australia. I end up getting fired. Like, it's just, we not only turned down a show, but we spent all this money that we got and we don't have a product. Cut to, I go on a road trip with my parents down to the Baja during Christmas. And my friends may become friends with this couple and their daughter. She's about 5-6 years older than me. And she's from LA and she says, what are you up to? And I explained to her what we're doing. And she said, oh, this is cool. Like, if you're thinking about doing this in Canada, you should like try doing it in the States. Cause I showed her this video that we had made. And I'm like, okay, like, what does that mean? She's like, oh, I know a couple people in LA. And so I end up getting a buddy pass, which is like a free flight from Victoria, BC down to LA, right? And I start to meet with just her friends. It's like one random manager, one random person to production company, whatever. And everyone's like, oh, this is kind of cool. I mean, in hindsight now, I just know that that's what everyone says in LA. Right? So, but I come back, I'm like, guys, I think this is like, there's potential, you know? So I start doing trips down to LA and over a year, we get represented, we make a pilot, we find a production company to partner with, we pitch it around. We MTV and ABC both are interested. We end up going with MTV because the president at the time understood the ethos of the show and was going to allow us to be executive producers, be in total control. So now we drive our just purple nudist bus down to LA and start making this TV show with no experience in production. And we're like, okay, we're going after big list items. Play basketball with President Obama, streak a field and get away with it. You know, like ask out the girl of our dreams, like the biggest, you know, celebrity crush we have, you know, make $1 million, survive on a deserted island. Geez, like, the biggest items on the list. And then, you know, we're going to do big gifts. Like, we're going to change, you know, try and change people's lives. And so we get down and we're like, okay, let's make a show. And then we learn how reality TV is made and it's produced. And we're like, no. Like, we're going to do it. And they're like, yeah, we'll call ahead and we'll clear it because you got to like clear the venue for you to go film. And we're like, but then they know we're going to be there. And that's, we're breaking in. That's the whole point, right? Like, whether it's like breaking into the CMAs to dunk and ask out Taylor Swift or whatever. So we push back, long story longer. We maintained that control and we made the show the way that we wanted to, which was like real. And so for 2 seasons, we made this show. I don't remember like any of it because it was a black hole of just like working the hardest we've ever worked. And we created the show and we were super proud of it. And after that, then we crossed off, read a New York Times bestseller. And we kind of made this announcement to our Facebook community. We're like, if we hit number one New York Times, we'll send our book to space. And we're like, we'll never hit New York, not number one. But we put the book out and it hit number one. And then we're like, oh crap, we gotta figure out a way to send the book to space. So then we have to like find an old neighbor that we grew up with who's a retired aeronautical engineer, and we built this contraption with a weather balloon that sent the book up into literally like up into the atmosphere with a GoPro so it could capture it, and a tracking device that we could basically track it once the parachute deployed, and it made it back to the desert. It was total, like, it was pretty dangerous, actually, now that I think of it. But, you know, so, and this, like, kind of just catapulted this journey where, as I said before, these list items that, when we wrote these list items down back in 2006, it was kind of a joke, right? It was like, what's the most impossible thing we can think of? Pay basketball with President Obama. Yes. You know, sit with Oprah. You know, like, we're on an island in Canada. This is just the most ridiculous thing we can think of. And then all of a sudden, all these list items started happening. And what was interesting is as more and more of those big dominoes fell, you had no choice but to suddenly believe that you could do anything, right? Before, there was this doubt, like, I don't know if it's possible. But once you climb a couple of those mountains, something changes in you. Like, your core DNA shifts and you think, well, it's not can I do it, it's do I want to do it? Because I know it's gonna be a shit ton of work if I do it and I wanna go down this path. I know I can, but it's do I want to?
And do I want to is like, do I have the will? Do I have the resolve?
And the passion, the true, like the right passion.
Because I'm sure sometimes in this, and this is the next thing that we'll go into, but I want you to finish, is that you gotta like, people are offering you support, but you gotta like convince people, you gotta like pull strings, you gotta like, so it's scary to do.
Yeah, man. And our, even, you know, in the MTV days and outside of that, but especially in the MTV days, because I think people think, well, you had an MTV show, of course you're going to do those things. Like, MTV will make a call. Well, our deal with MTV was like, it's just the four of us. We are executive producers of the show. We hired our friends as the film crew. We did the hiring of the editors. We edited the things, you know, on our own in the bays. We slept in the bays, but we did not have outside help. Because it was like, what's the point? So it's just like, when we tried to get Jay-Z to play at a house party, you know, we're just like knocking on doors. We're just doing whatever we can to follow any leads we can to try and make this stuff happen. Like, when we told MTV we're gonna try and play basketball with President Obama, they were like, no, like that, you're gonna waste the budget for the episode. And we were like, well, we've already decided. And we failed. And the episode was left as a failure. And we were just like, that's okay. Like, that's what happened, you know? And then, you know, a number of months later, it ended up coming to fruition. And we did play basketball with the president, which is a whole longer story that we can talk about later. But the idea was like, yes, we were just hustling to try and make this stuff happen.
You know, there's a couple themes in that. And one of the themes is announcing a goal. Mm. The other thing that was there was you didn't get support from MTV and then have fixers following you around. You didn't have the whole Viacom network doing this, but you guys did have to ask for favors. Where does, for our listeners and they're thinking about their own goals, where does relying on the support of others and asking for help play into their own bucket list?
Hugely important. Hugely important. Because I mentioned there's these three things that stop us from going after our personal goals. One is that there's no deadlines for personal goals, but we have deadlines for other goal sets in our lives. So with personal goals, because there's no deadlines, we push them, we push them, we push them. So we need to start to create accountability around our personal goals to drive ourselves forward. How do we create accountability? We share our goals. Because when I tell you my dream, I then feel a little bit accountable to you because I just spoke it. Now you know what I want to do. So that creates a bit of accountability. When you write down your goals, you create accountability because all of a sudden it's not an idea and a thought. It's actually real. Small step of accountability, but it actually starts to drive you forward. So you have to get over the fear of what other people might think before you share your goals. But what happens is when you share your list, then people can help you. And when we look back, right, that's the only way that we cross things off our list is through the help of other people, ultimately, right? Not fixers, but when we announce our goal, when we go after, you know, strategically, this person might be able to help. This is what we want to do. Can you help us? They put us in touch with someone else. That's how you get down the path to your goal. But if you don't share your goals, you're on your own. And then you just have less of a percentage, a chance of achieving it, right? Like think about, let's compare a work challenge and a professional, a work challenge and a personal challenge. With a work challenge, like we hit a roadblock at work, what do? You go to your boss, you go to a colleague, you ask someone else, hey, check it out. I'm coming up against this. Have you ever been through some of this? What have you done? You know, I don't know what to do. You collaborate, you ask for help, you go to a leader, you ask people for advice. With personal goals, we tend not to do it because of that fear, which just means we don't have that collaboration on our side. So share your goals. And if you can also create an accountability buddy, someone that checks in with you down the line, you are then 77% more likely to achieve your goal just by having someone check in with you. And when you think about it, in a lot of ways, that's what a leader is, a boss, right? Helps you set a goal, then keeps you accountable by checking in. You don't want to let the boss down. Of course, there's higher consequences because you're getting paid, you might get fired, but that's a framework of accountability that works. Create that same framework in your personal life and around your personal goals, and it will drive you forward. Do bucket list meetups, you know, or have, that's like when you train with someone in a marathon, you have a higher chance of actually sticking with it and completing it is because you have that simple framework of accountability. So it seems small, but it's so important. It's so important to share your goals, to write down your goals, to create that accountability.
To share your goals, to create that accountability, but also to ask for help.
Yes. And I think that, again, oftentimes we feel like that is maybe being a burden. But people, as I said, are typically more willing to give you help than you think they are. And when you ask for help, a lot of times you're also helping them, because you give them an opportunity to help you.
Yeah, you give them permission. We have a dear friend of mine, Omid Naeem, Dr. Omid Naeem, integrative psychiatrist here in Los Angeles. He says, you know, when we create friction and we rely on people, that creates connection. He's like, I do this exercise where I'll take an Uber to my kids' school to drop them off. And then after I drop them off, I'll ask one of the parents, you know, that I know that lives semi around me here in Los Angeles. Hey, would you mind giving me a ride back? And they're like, first of all, they're like shocked because like, what? You're in LA, you don't have a car. Like, how the hell did you get here? And then he's like, you know, hey, if it's not too much out of your way, could I get a ride back with you? And they're like, yeah, sure. And in the car, they start talking and they start connecting. And they're like, he's like, yeah, you know, I just found this is a great way to meet parents. And by the way, I drive on these days. So if you ever want to do the same thing, I'll drop you off. Or that dependency, that reliance creates connection. You know, I spend approximately about 10 hours a week of my time that I meet up with entrepreneurs. I give people advice. I talk to people about how to launch their book or how to create a bestseller or whatever it might be. And I like to do that. That's actually fun for me. Instead of watching Netflix, instead of watching other stuff, I like to do those things. But then I started realizing something was happening, that even though I was available, people wouldn't always ask me for follow-up advice. And I asked a friend one time, hey, you know, if, I'm here. If you ever want to meet up, like, let me know. He's like, dude, you are so giving. I actually feel it's totally out of balance because you never ask me for anything.
Yeah.
And so I feel like it's almost like very one-sided. I don't actually feel like we're that close. And I was like, wow, that's actually really powerful to hear. And so I would ask sometimes, like, hey, could you do this for a friend, or could you do that? And the bonds that it brings together. Now, sometimes when I share this, people say, but I've had that one time that somebody said no, and that like crushed them. You know, they needed help, whatever version of that help was, with somebody who was close. I'm sure people have asked you that too. For that person who's listening here and says, you know, I've asked people, or I've asked my friends or my family or other people to support me with these goals and dreams, and they've said no. What would you share with them?
Persist. I think that this idea of being relentless is, you just have to continue to charge forward. I mean, you know it better than anyone. You know, it just takes work. It just takes a grind to succeed at some of these things that are important to you. And it is a numbers game, right? When you try again and again and again and again, you increase your chances of success. Like, you can get 5 no's, 10 no's, 100 no's. Sometimes you just need one yes. You just need one person to say, yeah, I'll help you. And you're not done until you hit your yes. So try not to take it personally. I know it's hard because you're so it's so important to you. But sometimes people just don't have the capacity. They're just like, who knows what's going on? Maybe their wife is sick, you know, maybe their kids are just dropped out of school because they got depressed, or you just don't know what people are going through or the other things that they're dealing with. They just may not have the physical space to make it happen. And chalk it up to, okay, I tried, let's just try another.
Yeah, don't judge them for that.
So
don't
judge
know what's going on in their world.
You just really don't. You don't assume the worst. Assume like perhaps their dad just died. Like, if their dad just died, do you expect them to take an hour to sit down with you? You know, no, of course not. Like, so that may have happened, who knows? So just don't take it personally. It's not about you, it's actually not, right? Like, it's about them, because they're making the decision based on what their capacity is. And sometimes you get them on the wrong day, or something's going on with them. So chalk it up to, great, try next one.
And part of that persistence could be creating a new friend group, or going to a friend of a friend, or going to other people that are out there. I want to ask you a question. Have you seen this? My friend Michael Simmons, who writes sometimes for Forbes, he writes a lot on this science of network dynamics, like how relationships happen, how we can pursue our goals and dreams, how people leapfrog in their life. And I'm blanking on the researcher that he featured from Chicago that was one of the universities. But one of the things he talks about is that sometimes we're more likely to get help from a lukewarm contact than some of the closest people that we know. Because some of the closest people we know, like our closest friends that we know, like from growing up from childhood, or our cousins or our family, sometimes we don't always get help from them. And he has a theory on that. And he says, when people think they know you, they think they know what you're capable of.
Right.
And when we go to people who don't know us as well, but can still see what we're shooting for, they can help us in a way and see us in with less judgment and baggage than we've had before. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think that's brilliant. I've never heard that before, but I think it really resonates. If I think about the people that helped us, I don't think it was any real close friends. Keep in mind, we didn't really tell any of our close friends or, you know, extended family what we were doing in the beginning, because kind of exactly that. We didn't want to be judged, and we didn't know if they would understand. And but as time went on, it was those second, third degree connections that ended up helping, or strangers, a lot of strangers, right? Like, strangers came out of the woodwork to help us. And, you know, I think that's a really cool point. And it's inspiring too. It's uplifting to think about that, because you have so many more people to reach out to get help from.
So true. So we kind of teased about it, but there's actually a methodology that you teach. You know, you go and talk places and other stuff when it comes to taking these items that have been buried, bringing them up, and actually seeing through fruition. It's a five-step formula. So can you cover that? We've touched on a couple of them, but I'd love to walk the audience through it.
Yeah, we have. And I think that what I'll do is I'll go through them pretty quickly, and so you can kind of wrap your head around them as five steps, and then we can dive into some of them individually. But the first is write down your goals, right? This idea of taking this idea, this thought in your head, making it real. And what you do then is you're sort of building a foundation for your dreams to grow. And now you have a reminder that they exist. So when you stray from these things that are important, this brings you back. So you've taken the time to think about what's important to you. You've put it on this reminder, and now it exists. And so you're 42% more likely to achieve your goal just by writing it down, from Dr. Gail Matthews out of Dominican University in California. So 42%, that's easy. 42%, take it. The second is share your goals. You know, we've talked a lot about that, the power of sharing your goals, getting over that fear of what other people think, or the fear of failure, so they can help, and asking for help, but not feeling guilty by doing so.
Is there ever a time, I know you're going through the list, but is there ever a time that you don't share your goals? Is there a time that it's beneficial to keep it close to your chest?
Yeah, I think everybody feels a little bit differently about this. I've met people that really feel like there's a power to holding it close and not sharing it. I think that is true up to a point. As long as you are not sharing it, not sharing it because, you know, there's any type of fear or, but, you know, I think that ultimately you strike the balance of sharing it enough so that you can get help, but not sharing it too much that you sort of lose that power. And also you're just sharing it for sharing's sake. You know, I think there's people that all they do is share their goals. And it gets to the point where it's like, okay, like I get it. You know, like you're just talking about it. But so you don't want to just talk about it. And I think too, you can define the share and you can be intentional with it. So what I mean by that is, let's say you want to write a book, right? You share your goal. I want to write a book with your Facebook community. Okay, cool. Like maybe someone will help you. Or you could go to your friend and say, hey, do you know someone that's written a book? Yeah, my uncle wrote a book, or my, you know, friend is an agent, you know. Oh, can I talk with them? Like, so then you're sharing it with intention, and you're actually like being laser focused on who you're reaching out to, so you have a higher chance of getting what you want. And then you go to that person that wrote a book. Hey, I'm trying to write a book. Like, so they come to you. I'm trying to write a book. Could I borrow 10 minutes of your time? I just want to learn about the first step I need to do to write a proposal. Like, I have no idea. I don't know how to write a proposal. I don't know how to get an agent. You know, so you be intentional. And
I love that. Sharing with intention.
Yeah.
I think those are two really important themes on that is, one, are you not sharing because of fear?
Mm-hmm.
And then number two, if you're in history of oversharing, the other extreme, are you, which still really connects to fear too, are you sharing, can you step into sharing with intention?
Yeah.
Oh, those are both great. So sorry I interrupted you. So that was about the talking about your list, sharing it with intention with other people.
Yep. So you got the first is write it down. Two is share it. Three, we've also touched on, persist. Be relentless. It's just, you got to do the work. You know how much work it takes to build something. I think most people pretend that external forces are the reason that they fail, when the simple truth, you fail because you stop trying. So this idea of being persistent, and again, I think it's nuanced, just like sharing. It's nuanced because you don't want to just bang your head against the door again and again and again. You don't want to send the same email every day to that person that you're trying to get a hold of, right? That's just going to piss them off. So you want to share with originality. You want to share with you want to be persistent with originality. You want to be persistent with creativity. So what does that mean? I'll give you an example. So there's this old, like, I don't know if it's a parable or if it actually is true, but it's a good example. Someone's trying to get a job. He can't get an interview. So he sends a gift to the boss, right? The boss gets this box that's wrapped up. It's a gift. He opens it up and he opens up the gift and it's a shoe. And if there's a note that says, now that I've got my foot in the door, can I have an interview? And the idea is people really respect originality and that creativity. And that's how you break through the noise sometimes, right?
Because it shows intention. It shows caring.
It shows caring. It shows creativity. And it shows originality. I'll give you an example. This is something that we've always abided by. I think it's also because it's our personality, but it ended up serving us so well. Because when we tried to play basketball with President Obama, we tried everything. We did not know what would work. And we stood outside the White House with signs wearing 1970s basketball uniforms. We sent emails to the personal aide of the president challenging him and the president to a basketball game and would set a time and a date and show up with our basketball and our basketball gear. We would go to the Y because we heard that some of the senior officials would work out at the Y and follow the Secretary of Treasury into the pool without a bathing suit on, just a towel, just to talk with him. We like met with congressmen and senators, anyone we could in Washington, say, this is what we're trying to do. We sent emails, we did social campaigns, whatever we could. And I think that there was, if you think about how many people were trying to shake hands with the president, and then how many people were trying to play basketball with the president, well, there was probably way more people that were trying to shake hands with the president, less people that were trying to play basketball with the president, less people that were then staying out front of the White House in short shorts and signs saying, trying to play, you know, we challenge you to a basketball game. Less people that were, you know, doing all these myriad of things that we didn't know what was going to get through. But ultimately, it was one of those things. And he heard about it, and we got invited to the White House to do a tour.
Which one of those things do you know?
So it was. So actually, it's funny. This is ended up what happened. This is what happened from what we heard. So I told you there was a failure in the episode.
Right.
So what we learned afterwards, that President Obama was, you know, in the White House late one night or something, came across our episode on MTV.
Just on his own accord.
On his own accord, or maybe his daughter watched it. I don't know. Tough to, I don't know exactly. Watched the episode. Or, you know, heard about it from his daughter. Next day, the personal aide of the president came into the White House, and a staff member was like, hey, like, POTUS is pissed. And the personal aide of the president, who we had been in contact with, and he was trying to make it happen, and we got an official no from the press team. He gets President Obama in between meetings, and he's like, hey, what's going on? And the president says, why haven't I played basketball with the Buried Life guys? And he says, well, you know, put it through the channels, and the press team denied it. And he said, okay, we'll make it happen. And he said, well, do you want to run it through the press team? And he said, I'm the president. And so it was the personal aide's job to get us to the White House. We, of course, had no idea that we were going to meet the president. We got invited to give it, to have a tour of the White House basketball courts. So we're shooting around on the basketball courts. We think the president's out of town. And lo and behold, President Obama strolls on the court, totally surprises us.
Wow. Was the whole gang there?
All the four of us were there. The president was there, the personal aide, the White House photographer, and we shot around with the president for like 20 minutes. So point being is when what we heard was like these lengths that we sort of went to that were outside of the box, you know, the level of persistence, the originality, it got his attention. And I think that that happens a lot. So when you are being persistent, think creatively, because the person on the other end will respect that.
I love that. You know, there's a book that I came across a few years ago. It's called The Five Regrets of the Dying by Bronnie Ware. And messaged a couple times with her on Instagram. Would love to get her on the podcast one day. And yeah, you know, if you're familiar with her work, which I think you probably are, some of our listeners are not, but she basically was a palliative care nurse in Australia and would sit with people who are on their deathbed. And something really unique happens, I think, when people are on their deathbed. It's just that, you know, often if they're in an okay mental state, like the truth comes out.
Mm-hmm.
the truth comes out, going back to your analogy, in your 20s, you're worried about this, in your 40s, this, and when you're 60, 70, 80 plus, there's like nobody cares anyway, so why did I give it so much?
Deathbed, you don't give a fuck.
You don't give a fuck. And so she started writing down these regrets. And one of the top regrets was, which comes back to the central story, I wish I had the courage to live the life that I was meant to live, not the life that other people wanted me to live.
Yeah.
And I think that when I think about the Buried Life Project, the book, the movement, your talks, I often think about, why do you think it is that we give greater weight, especially when we're not on our deathbed, why do we give greater weight to the life that others want us to live when we're younger? And when I say younger, I mean younger than on our deathbed. Why is it that we give greater weight and that we put everybody else's deadlines, priorities, vision for our life ahead of what we internally might be feeling?
I think part of the reason is we really care about what other people think of us. And, you know, a lot of times to the detriment of our own well-being. And I definitely struggle with that a lot. You know, I care about what other people think about me. And it's something that you need to be conscious of. Are you making this decision for you? Or are you making this decision for other people? Not necessarily what other people want for you, but because you want to be seen in a certain way by other people. And so part of that is, you know, we've been exposed to this idea of what is success, which is ultimately, like, if you look at the five regrets of the dying, none of them cost money, right? It's actually, I wish I worked less is one of them, right? Mm-hmm. And it's, I wish that I lived a life for me, not other people. I wish I would have reconnected with people I lost touch with.
Old friendships.
So it's just ironic that these are the five biggest regrets that people traditionally will have at the end of their life. And none of them really cost a dollar. In fact, it's actually the opposite. People say, I wish I worked less. And so we're not serving ourselves with these missions. You know, we're serving what we think other people want for us, or we're serving this image. And I think it's human nature, and it's something that is like you got to build acute awareness or these reminders to pull you back. That's why death is such a good mechanism to remind you of what's important. And if you can keep death close to you, man, you have a crystal clear perspective, and it's just a hard thing to do. Like, I talk about it all the time, and I get lost all the time. So it's finding these things that pull you back to that true course. It's funny that the last line of the Buried Life poem is, you know, is tracking our true original course. And as you get buried, you get off course, and it's all about coming back to that true original course. And I guess from the book, the top five regrets, and what we've been talking about, that's kind of what it all comes down to.
When you make your first bucket list, or you've had some practice at it, what's the practicalities on it? How often are you revisiting it? How often are you looking at it to check in and ask yourself, does this still matter to me?
Good question.
Does this still mean something? Is this still something I want?
Yeah. So this is what I would suggest. I'd say, get a journal or a book or something that you can keep, and write your list. And again, think about all aspects of your life. You know, there's these 12 categories of life. You can Google 12 categories of life if you want to check in on those. It's from a book called The Dream Manager by Matthew Kelly, which is a phenomenal book. So you write your list, and then you identify the most important things, and you write one action item. What's the first step? And you give yourself some sort of accountability. I need to do this in 48 hours. I need an accountability to check in on me, whatever. Create that system of accountability, and then check in every couple months, you know, every quarter or so. Look at your list and rewrite your list. Like, what stuff is not important to you anymore? Get rid of it. What stuff do you still important to you? Pull it over to the new list. Add stuff that's new passions. So check it every couple months. Check it twice a year. And over time, what will happen is at first your list is going to fall into two camps. There's going to be this list items in your list that you just you can do, but you haven't pulled the trigger on, like book a trip, you know, make that call. You know how to do them, you just haven't done them yet. And then there's this the items on the list that are just feel impossible. I don't know how the hell I'm going to do those things. And over time, as you continue to write your list and as time goes on, you'll flip back to that first list, and those things that you thought were impossible, you'll have done. Or at least you'll see a plausible way that you can get to those things, and you'll start taking that first, second, third step to those things. And you'll realize over time that you can actually do those things. So keep your list in one book or in one journal. Check in on it every couple months, continue to update it. It's a living organism, right? As I said, it's a reflection of you. So as you grow and change and your hopes and dreams change, your list should change as well. And get after it.
What makes a bucket list different from just a random group of goals that somebody would set? Is there a defining question or framework that we should look at? Because somebody might say, you know, I set some goals or I might set some resolutions here and there, but a bucket list feels like it's something different. Not that there might not be overlapping aspects, but what makes a bucket list special?
I think it's tapping into that feeling. You know, I think if you have a to-do list, you have things you have to do, you know, you just got to get them done. That's a to-do list. A bucket list is rooted in a feeling, whether that's that feeling of curiosity or joy or excitement or fulfillment or, you know, that fuzzy feeling around your heart. And so I think that that is a good place for those list items to grow from.
Is it also the connection to death? Because, you know, one of the questions you guys were asking is like, yeah, what do you want to do before you die? That's a different perspective of like, just like, what's one of my goals for this year?
Yes.
Not that that's any less powerful, but something happens when you ask yourself, what do I want to do?
Mm-hmm.
What do I want to do before I die?
Yeah. And you know what a good exercise to do is to actually picture yourself on your deathbed, looking back onto this moment in time and asking your future self, will I be happy with the time I'm spending focused on me? And if the answer is yes, that's awesome. But check in every once in a while, right? Like, this is a muscle that we all need to build. If the answer is no, and your future self says, I'm not going to be happy with the time you're spending focused on you, then just ask your future self, well, then what will you be happy with? And that answer is different for everybody. But that mechanism, checking in, touching base with that mortality is important. You know, the other thing that's important, you can use the same device, is when you're at a crossroads or you're trying to make a decision. Should I turn left? Should I turn right? Should I go after this thing? Should I stay with the job I'm doing right now? That's an example. Should I go after this new thing? Or should I stay with the job I'm at right now? Ask your future self, will you regret not going after it? And if the answer is yes, you have to do it.
It's a great centering question, because sometimes we don't know if we're confused because of fear or if we just genuinely don't know. Like, confusion is, okay, I don't know the answer. I mean, sorry, confusion is not, I don't know the answer. Somebody asks you, what's the capital of this country or this or that? It's like, I don't know. That's not being confused. You just don't know the answer.
Yeah.
But confusion seems to be this layer of being this push and pull, this tug of war that happens because we want to do something, but we're afraid of what happens if it doesn't work out.
Yeah. So it cuts through the BS.
Yeah. If I didn't do this, would I regret it?
Black or white.
When you on a personal level think about your bucket list, does it still show up in that same way? Do you have a book that you keep around? Are you reorienting at the beginning of the year? Like, how are you thinking about it on a personal level?
Yeah. So I rewrite my list twice a year. But I do it also with my fiance. So I have my list, she has her list, and then we have a combined list. And so I think that's a great thing to think about, especially with families. You know, family bucket list. I've heard folks that have seen me speak, they go and they do a summer list with their young kids. So they do like a bucket list for the summer. What are we going to do this summer? And they help their kids do those things. And then there's family bucket lists and really touching story. A gentleman came up to me after a keynote and he said, it was the second time he saw me speak. And he said, the first time I saw you speak right after, right before, about 3 weeks before I saw you speak, my daughter was hit by a car and she passed away. Mm. And after your talk, I drove back home and I thought, you know what, I'm going to ask my other three kids what's on their list. But he said, I also sort of gave them this framework that was, tell me things on your list that I can help make happen, that are up to this amount and that your mother and I can be a part of, right? So he basically asked them for their list, helped them achieve those things, but also wanted to incorporate himself and his wife into that process in some way, shape, or form. So, and he saw me the second time and he said that his son was a chef and his dream was to cook across Europe or something. And they just got back from a trip where they were all over Europe. And so, you know, this idea of doing a list with someone else that you love is important. I just asked my dad what was on his list and it was his 70th birthday. And, he had told me prior that he always wanted to go to New Orleans, never been to New Orleans. And so on his 70th birthday, I surprised him with a trip to New Orleans, which we're going on next weekend.
Oh, it's super exciting.
Yeah. So it's his 70th birthday trip. But what's really cool is one of my best childhood friends and his dad, who's really good friends with my dad, is also coming back from Victoria. So we're all meeting in New Orleans for 2 days. So I do it with my fiance and we have this list together. But I think too, what's interesting is as you do this more and more, and I've been doing it for years, it's slowly this idea becomes a lifestyle. And you start to subconsciously prioritize things that are your list items, things that are truly important to you. You know, and so you start to move through the world in a way where you're subconsciously, you know, just doing trying to do the things that would be, you know, following your true course. So, you know, we all need those reminders, and it's definitely not like I'm just walking through life living my purpose, but definitely over time, it's like osmosis, this sort of soaked in to allow me to kind of live this way in a way, shape, or form. You know, so it's cool.
So, some concluding thoughts and a question. A big part of the show was the one for us, one for somebody else.
Yeah.
And it was beautiful because you could capture on video, you know, you kind of had a group and camaraderie of a bunch of guys all doing it together at the same time. Now, as people are transitioning and they're listening and they're thinking about their own bucket list and they want to keep that alive, how can they also benefit from that? Because going back to that gentleman whose truck was broken down and didn't even have that to be able to, like, you know, conduct his landscaping business in the best way, had risen out of homelessness and was focused on just sort of serving other people, like, you guys wanted to help him. And when you did, all the feels in the world, yeah. Right? All the feels, all the energy, all the sense of, like, this is what it's really about. How could we as individuals on our bucket list think about helping other people when we don't? It's easier sometimes to think about, okay, what are our goals? Mm-hmm. What are the things that we want to do? What's on our bucket list before we want to die? How would you say we can include in the service element, which seems so transformative?
I think we think about, if we're thinking about the 12 categories of life, and giving back is one of those categories, we just think about how in my life can I be of service? And that can be as small as giving a compliment. You know, that can be as small as smiling, or if you notice someone looks like they're having a rough day, hey, how you doing? Like, all of those things, because of the ripple effect, have a real long tail impact. So, because when you help someone, you don't just help that one person, right? You help the people around them, like their friends and their family and the people they come into contact with. So that's sort of the ripple effect. Like, the whole idea of, like, kindness is contagious in my mind, that's just the ripple effect. Because when you do something nice for someone, they in turn, it changes them in some way, shape, or form, and that affects how they're being in the world, and they will, you know, affect someone else. Or it affects someone else that cares about them because they see them change in some way, and they're like, oh, that's awesome, you know, and then they're feeling a little bit different. So don't get overwhelmed with, how am I going to get this person a house? How am I going to get this person off the street or cure this epidemic, right? Like, small gives make a real impact. So you can always start there, and they don't cost any money. And also think about other ways that you can make an impact, and write those down. You know, just identify them, put some thought into it. You know, think about volunteering, or think about giving something away, or think about what do you do that is your gift, and how can you give that gift away, right? You know how to write books, get them on the New York Times bestseller list. That is your gift. You give that away. That's your act of service.
Writing a little less so marketing. Maybe I know about the marketing side.
Right. Yeah. But like, think about the ripple effect of that, those, you know, 10 hours.
And it could be something small. You are a great amateur DJ. You have a way of putting together playlists that like lifts people up. You know, I guess this goes right into like your point before, is that the same way that we ask for help on our goals, can we ask people, hey, who needs help? I'm good at this. Do you know anybody that needs that?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And what a cool thing to do.
What a cool thing to do, to go on social media, positive use of social media that's out there, say, you know what? I'm good at baking. Yeah. I'm good at this thing. I am really good at helping people prepare for job interviews. Mm-hmm. Everybody's good at something.
Yeah.
Everybody has something to give. Okay, you might not know somebody in your immediate network who needs that. Put it out there.
Yeah.
That can truly change somebody's life.
Yeah. And that's why we share our goals, because we give people the opportunity to offer that service. So, you know, when people share their goals in my keynotes, someone will put up their hand and say, I've always dreamed of playing the piano. And someone else will say, hey, I play the piano. I can teach you. Or someone will say, hey, I got a piano collecting dust in my basement. You can have it. Right? It's crazy. And so you want to give people that opportunity, and you want to extend that opportunity to other people. And I think that also, you can think about it the same way when you are struggling, right? If you're going through a depression, or you're going through anxiety, or you're going through any number of mental health challenges, I think we don't reach out for help sometimes because we think it's a burden. You know, we think we're going to, or the fear of what it's going to look like. Well, when you reach out for help, what you're really doing is you're opening the door for them to come back to you in their time of need. Because as human beings, we're all going to go through ups and downs. We're all going to hit a crisis. And so you're extending an olive branch actually out to them to come back to you. You're creating that real connection so that then they have an olive branch to come back when they're in their time of need. And so this idea that we need to keep ourselves isolated in these moments of crisis are really perpetuating the crisis itself, because we think that we're messed up. You know, we're like, I'm fucked up. And the reality is, you're not. Everyone around you is going through something. That person sitting next to you might be going through the exact same thing. And by you reaching out, you're actually helping the crisis, because you're normalizing the conversation, and the stigma that is wrapped around the conversation is not serving anybody. So you're doing a huge amount of service just by talking about it for the global good. And so, you know, I think that it's important to think about that when we're faced with these personal struggles that everybody faces. You know, it's like what the Buddha says, to be human is to struggle. And this is just the existence. It's okay. So important to remember that.
Ben, this has been a fantastic conversation. I want to appreciate you and acknowledge you for coming on the podcast and really talking about living a regret-free life.
Yeah.
You know, just even sometimes, even when things don't, because the beauty is that even when things don't work out, even if you never got a chance to play basketball with President Obama, or I'm sure there's a bunch of other goals in your life that you've shot for that haven't worked out in the way that you originally intended. Mm. Just even going for it, acknowledging it, fueling it, flowering that garden that we have inside, that vision of something that we want to grow, just even trying it actually just removes the regret in the first place. So I want to thank you for coming on the show and sharing with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you and follow the great work that you're continuing down this path that you guys started back in 2002?
Yeah, it's 2006.
2006.
Yeah, 14 or so years ago. Well, you know what I would say is encourage people to share their list with me. I love to, like, I can be your accountability buddy. If you tag me on Instagram with your list or send it to me, all my socials are just at Ben Nempton, which is my full name. So share your list with me, share with you as well, tag both of us. And that's where you can find me. And, you know, I'll be there to answer any questions that, that anybody else has. So, yeah, thank you for this, like, really energizing conversation.
Absolutely. So one more follow-up question. You're encouraging people to, you know, you had shared with our listeners earlier that when you share an item from your bucket list, you never know what support comes out from the audience that's out there listening to them. And also, too, it gives them permission to share theirs. So give me one item that's on your bucket list that's there that you'd feel comfortable sharing with our audience. Because one, you never know who's listening. And number two, that'll maybe give them permission to tag you on Instagram.
Yeah, so number 100 on the list. So we've crossed off 91 of 100 list items.
These and are the we is you and your fiance.
Oh, sorry. This is we as in like myself and the three Barry.
Okay, got
guys.
It. So that so list
the
is
original,
still going.
The original list is kind of, it's sort of now like a... it's emblematic, right?
Yeah.
And really the two things that we would like to do is make a movie, right? Because we haven't finished the film. So we want to make that documentary. And number 100 is go to space, which is like for us, you know, it's the ultimate moonshot. And so if you have any connections to space, that's what I would say to the audience, you know, let me know. Because that's something that, one of us is going to go do something in space.
Yeah.
And then on... my personal list is to write a book.
So, write a book, just a solo book.
Yes.
Like now a follow-up to your number one New York Times bestseller, something that you'd want to put out there.
Exactly, yeah. Like all of, you know, really around the themes that we've been talking about. Because the first book is actually more about other people's dreams that we brought to life through different by different artists, and then we tell our story. But what I'd like to do is dive deeper into this stuff. So, yeah.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. The book is out there. The first book is out there. The second book is out there in the universe. It's going to be coming. What do you want to do before you die? It's in the show notes, The Buried Life. We'll have a link to all of that. And some great talks that you've had online and reels and other stuff that I think you're just a really incredible speaker. And I want to share that. And you just got acknowledged by that. I forget the group's name, but you got voted one of the top motivational speakers that are out there. So congratulations.
Thank you.
So we'll include some of those as well. Ben, thanks for coming on the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thanks, you. Appreciate it.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.